Another edition of Book Corner, ladies and gentlemen. It's unbelievable to have the opportunity to speak with Michael Weinreb today. His book, Seasons of Saturdays, A History of College Football in 14 Games, Tony Basilio reporting. Michael Weinreb, by the way, writes college football for Sports on Earth, online magazine owned by USA Today. He's also a contributing writer for GQ, New York Times, ESPN, Grantland. He's been featured all over the place. Which leads me to this, Michael, as I welcome you with me. What in the world are you doing with me if you're so decorated?
I think it's all an act, to be honest. I don't think any of that's actually really being decorated. So I'm just playing an expert more than anything else. But aren't we all playing experts on some level?
I think we are. I think it's all a game of make-believe, especially as it comes to college football. You detail the history of college football, and you take 14 football games to do so through the history of the game. But college football's always been kind of a deal where, and you accent this in your book, where they make it up as they go along as well, don't they?
Oh, they totally do. I mean, they made it up from the beginning. I was just thinking about this again today. If you go back to the very first college football season, you know, it's Princeton and Rutgers, and they play each other twice, and they each win a game. And then, you know, you go back and you look who claims the quote-unquote national championship from that year, and both teams claim the national championship from that year, even though there were two games and they each played each other once and each won one game, you know. So that's what we're dealing with here. That's kind of the baseline for where everything began. And I call it, through the book, I call it the argument with a capital A, because I think that's what has driven college football from the beginning, is this notion that we're never going to have a perfect system and we're never going to be able to have a perfect way of determining who the champion in this sport is. And that's what makes it so crazy, but that's what also makes it so great, too.
And you make a great point in your book, now that we're getting ready to get into the playoff era, and this is all about the non-playoff era, from the time where many teams wouldn't play in bowl games because they felt like it was a compromise, which is something you talk about. Even the Big Ten into the mid to late 60s, which were things I didn't realize, but now that we're going to have this playoff, people act as if we're going to crown a champion and it's going to be the be-all and end-all and we're going to end all the discussion and the best team will win. Well, I would submit, as you say in the book, and I think it's well put, how many times is that basketball team that wins a national championship, how many times is that the best team? And they have to win six games to do it.
Yeah, and I think that's what the argument comes down to. I think when you look at pro sports, I think people who watch pro sports and who are fans of pro sports first, they look at it and they say, well, we want to determine who the best team is. And we want a system that determines who the best team is. So, you know, in the NBA, you have, you know, a seven-game series and all these playoff series to determine who the best team is. But I think in college sports, it's different. I think in college sports, you shouldn't be as worried about determining the best team. You should just find a way to determine a winner. And I think that's the way it should be. It should be an inclusive system where any team can win. And that's what makes those first couple of rounds of the NCAA tournament so great. And that's what makes college football so great, is that there is this possibility. You know, and who would have thought coming into the year you'd have Ole Miss and Mississippi State at the top of the standings? Nobody saw that coming. But, you know, that's kind of the way things have shaken out. The sort of the beauty of college football is that there's never is going to be a perfect system. We're just always going to be toying with it and playing with it to see how much closer we can get to this ideal.
And it's a mythical ideal. That's the whole thing. See, they say with national champion that you guys have crowned all these years is mythical. It's all mythical. Furthermore, as we talk about college football, my concern, which is your concern, and you touch on this later in the book, what we're about to do to the game, Michael, no one really knows, but I do know this. It may lose some of what makes it unique and special in our sports landscape, and that's too bad.
I think that's something that you have to be concerned with as the money continues to rise to the top. I've written a couple times this year about Marshall's kind of the small school du jour this year, undefeated, and has absolutely no chance of getting into that playoff. And maybe you can make the case that they don't deserve to because of the schedule they played. But it does seem like we're kind of purposely limiting opportunity just because of the way the money is flowing in, that these top schools are setting themselves off from that second tier of schools. And all the changes that are going to happen, A lot of them I agree with. I do think that that the players are kind of getting a raw deal here in terms of being able to profit off their name and likeness, for instance. This whole Todd Gurley autograph thing is ridiculous, and I think we all recognize that. But I think as you make these changes, you also just want to be really careful that you keep that character of the sport that we've had all these years that feels sort of, a little bit random and a little bit haphazard, but also feels kind of inclusive, too, in a way that I think maybe pro sports don't have that same feel.
Michael Weinreb's our guest from Scribner. His book is called Season of Saturdays. Let me tell you, with Christmas around the corner, if you have a college football fan in your family, this would be a great book for them to get. And I'll tell you what they will do, is they will look back some of these things fondly. Now, I wasn't born for some of them, like the 66 game, November the 11th, 1966, Notre Dame and Michigan State tie 10-10 back in the day, which this chapter and a couple others in the book had me thinking back to a time where a tie game was such a beautiful thing in college football, and we don't have it anymore. And I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing, because in one sense, I say ties were beautiful in a nostalgic way, unless you were involved in one, and then they were frustrating. But Notre Dame back in the day sort of took an easy way out, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I mean, you can argue that they had a chance to win that game in the end, and they didn't take that opportunity because they knew that they were Notre Dame. And at that point, especially in the 1960s when everything was dictated by polls, that Notre Dame had an inherent advantage because Brockney back in the day had sort of courted the New York sports writers, and there was this huge contingent of them who, I don't want to say they were in the tank for Notre Dame, but they definitely were partisan toward Notre Dame. The coach of Notre Dame, who was Air Prestigian back then, did the smart thing in terms of playing for that tie and knowing that even if they play for that tie, that they're probably going to win the national championship, which they did. But yeah, I mean, I have that same feeling that you do about ties. There was something kind of crazy and beautiful about it that you could have these games that would just end up in ties, And you had the 2-point conversion in college for the very reason that, coaches should be able to not play for the tie. And I write about in the 80s when Tom Osborne decided to go for two in that famous national championship game, and it raised his stature more than anything else he did throughout his career was going for two in that situation to win the national championship instead of doing what Eric Barsegian had done 20 years earlier and play for the tie. Tom Osborne could have just kicked the extra point against Miami in 1984 and probably would have won the national championship with a tie. But he decided to go for two and decided to win the game. There was such interesting strategy involved in that, and it's just something that's kind of lost. There's such a fascinating history to college football and to all these different eras that I think a lot of fans don't know about. And I wanted to write it in a way that I hope would appeal to people who are either casual fans or who are rabid fans like me and just didn't know about how all this history is linked together. We have today.
And there's so many nuggets pointing toward the period that we now see. We're on the precipice of something that's unprecedented, but way back in 66, you point out that Duffy Daugherty at that time floated the possibility of an 8-team playoff even then. I mean, they've been talking about a playoff forever, it seems like, in college football.
If you want to talk about a sport that moves slow, college football is a sport that moves slow. And they were talking about overtime back then after that game. They were talking about a playoff back then, and what did it take us? It took probably 20 years to get overtime, and it's taken almost 50 years since then to get a playoff, and it's been almost 100 years since they started determining national championships in their own various ways. It's been 150 years, basically, since the sport started, so that's how long it's taken for us to get to this point where there is a playoff, and there is something kind of great about the fact that even now that there's a playoff, that we still have this argument, that you still have people who are going to be upset about things, who are going to accuse the playoff committee of being biased in some way, shape, or form. I think that's just part of what the sport is at this point. And I like it, too, because I think it kind of reflects America, too. I mean, we're sort of all these regionalized people who are arguing amongst ourselves about politics and culture and values and all these other things. And I think college football, because it's such a uniquely American sport, it's kind of cool that it reflects those values.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And you talk about the tug of war between the old guard in the 1960s giving way to all the strife in the 60s, which I thought was really well written and really well thought out by you and well fleshed out, even so much as Richard Nixon, in a very tone-deaf manner, getting involved in 1969 with the national championship chase. And quick aside for you, since you come from a Penn State family, as I do, I have a brother 10 years older who attended Penn State. And I remember when Richard Nixon was forced to resign, I was a young kid. I'm 47 now, so I would probably have been 7 or 8 at the time. But I can specifically remember my brother the night that he was resigning, pumping his fist in the air and saying, "Good, that SOB gave Texas a championship." I mean, I guess that's what it came down to for him. I never believed that story to be true and really never looked into it. You know, you hear things as a child and you just kind of go, that can't be so. But sure enough, you write about that here.
Yeah, I mean, how crazy is it that sports and politics can always kind of dovetail? But in this case, they dovetail directly. I mean, Richard Nixon decides to go to that Texas-Arkansas game, and he's going to declare whoever wins to be the national champion. And, of course, Penn State winds up going undefeated that year, too. And so Richard Nixon winds up pissing off the entire state of Pennsylvania by doing this. So he's trying to play politics by appealing to Southern voters, but he winds up alienating an entire other state in the process. And it's just this incredible moment where, and especially those games in the 60s and late 60s, where everything was happening with civil rights and all the campus unrest and everything else, you know, the epicenter of the 60s was on college campuses. And so it's impossible to write about college football without recognizing that all the changes that were happening in society were affecting college football. So I wanted to get at that, and I think that Nixon example is one of them, you know, where he's trying to appeal to the voters who happen to be very into college football in the South at that point, and winds up stepping in it. It's such a crazy time, and it was just so interesting to find out and to discover all these parallels between what was going on in society and what was going on in college football at that point.
You know, Michael, one thing that I'm really going to miss when we get into this playoff era are the people that love, and you were talking about before, the arguments. You found somebody, and I don't know where you found this individual, but it was a website or loves to go back and re-rank the teams. How could something matter to you that much where you would sit around and worry about what happened 50 or 60 years ago? Share with our listener exactly what that is and how you found that individual.
I just, you know, was doing some searching around, looking, you know, and you can find some guys who do retroactive polls. One of them is a guy named Richard Billingsley, who was actually involved in the whole, his was one of the BCS computers. So it makes a lot more sense for him because this is, you know, part of his job was to rank teams. And so he would go back in the past and look at teams from the past. But then there was another guy I found whose site is, and I recommend it if you're, you know, into college football history. It's called Tip Top 25, and I think you can just Google it and find it. I mean, it's just a guy who grew up a college football fan and started going back and reevaluating all these years and all these polls and looking at who should have been ranked where and who should be number one through all these seasons. It's kind of great because it's just this guy going back and saying, well, here's where they screwed this up. Here's where the pollsters screwed that up, you know, and you can go back and say, well, he's not thinking about this or he's not thinking about that, you know. It's pretty amazing that this guy, you know, just decided to do this on his own. It just shows you how much passion there is for this sport. It's all over the place.
But what I love about your book and the point you make, since I lived through especially a lot of that Penn State history, and I'm sure if you're a fan of other schools growing up or at one point in time, you become emotional about something, and then through time, through the lens of time at least, some of that emotion dissipates, and you may be able to look at it with a more objective eye. You make the point that there are several teams that won it or played for national championships that ought not have gotten that opportunity. And I thought that was really interesting how you were able to determine that in the book.
I think you can just go back and look, and you can see the mistakes. You can see where whatever the biases of the moment sort of played into mm-hmm. things, rightly or wrongly, you know. When you had that, you know, the one that I think of is that Alabama-Penn State game in
1979, when Alabama has this famous goal line stand. Alabama had lost to USC that year, and USC was also a one-loss team. It turned out Alabama and USC wound up having a split national championship. But when you look back on it and you think about it, I mean, if the team beats another team head-to-head, why should they be counted out of that national championship? For me, that was a very seminal game because I was a little kid and just started to get into college football. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought that was the be-all, end-all. But, you know, you look at it, the writers, I think, felt some sympathy toward Bear Bryant. He was starting to get to the end of his career, wasn't very healthy, and I think they wanted to give him that opportunity in the same way that, you know, in the 90s they decided to give Tom Osborne a national championship, despite the fact that Penn State also went undefeated in 1994. So if you can go back and look at those things and just see what the sentiment of the moment was, how all these subjective things were playing out, because when you have polls are inherently subjective, and that's what college football was based on. Up until the 90s, basically, was just polls, and even after that, the polls were still a huge part of it. So there's just always going to be this inherent subjectivity to it, which is what makes it so fascinating.
It absolutely makes it fascinating, and as you say, just the spirit that's in the air at certain times to give guys the shake and the benefit of the doubt. And I didn't realize that Bear Bryant was in such ill health, but even had such terrible alcohol problems that he was sent to a detox for a while. That was an interesting nugget you had here.
Yeah, yeah. What was that, late 70s?
Yeah.
He'd been around, been coaching since the 50s. And I think people knew that he was getting near the end. I think he lasted maybe five more years. And it turned out I think from what I remember, they won a national championship the next year. So all this giving him the title, you know, it's kind of the same thing that happened with Tom Osborne, where they yep. gave him an undisputed title in 1994, and then he winds up winning another one in 1995, you know. So oftentimes it's like, I think there's this inherent sympathy toward coaches who we recognize as great coaches who maybe we say they deserve to win a national championship or something like that. It just all goes into that giant pool of subjectivity that drives the entire sport.
And don't we love subjectivity? Because it gets to participate in the... Give me a pivot here for a second, if I can. You write about Michigan mm-hmm. men. You know, Michigan's... They're in a time of turmoil, just like we are here in Knoxville, Tennessee, or have been till Butch Jones got here. And whether or not he makes it is still a TBD. But Michigan knows they have a guy that's taking the death march here down the stretch, their head coach. They're going to try and go find somebody else. This whole concept of a Michigan man dates back a long time, doesn't it? You really did some great research here. And Rich Rodriguez, if you can elaborate here as to why he didn't fit. Did they really get on him for his grammar on coaches' shows and at press conferences? Is that really true?
Those are the reports that came out. I don't think that was the only factor, but I do think that there's this idealization of what a Michigan man is. And so I wanted to kind of pierce that armor a little bit. One of the things about the book is I go in stating my own biases. I grew up a Penn State fan, and so I grew up not liking Michigan. And so I go in and I say, okay, I did not like Michigan when I was growing up, but I want to do sort of a anthropological look here, you know, how this started and why people kind of view Michigan fans as a little more arrogant maybe than the rest of the Big Ten. And so, you know, you go back and you look at how they created this mythology under Fielding Yost back in the early 1900s, and how they had this ideal for what Michigan football should be and how it kind of stood above the fray. And as a Penn State fan, I can relate to that too, because I think that's what Penn State had under Joe Paterno. And I think that's what they thought they had for all these years. And that's a much more complicated story. But, you know, I think that's what's happened to Michigan at this point, is that they've tried to stick to these ideals of what Michigan football should be. Rich Rodriguez, for whatever reason, I think partly because of the offense that he played and partly just because of who he was, kind of, for lack of a better word, just kind of a simple guy from West Virginia, that I think he didn't fit in to what their idealization of what Michigan football is. But as it goes longer and longer and they're having less and less success, you have to start questioning that whole ideal and whether it's sustainable and whether they're sabotaging their own program through this notion they have of what a Michigan man should be. I think there's a lot of yearning for this era of Bo Schembechler and, you know, this tough guy thing. And so all those factors go into it. It'll be interesting to see where they go now, because they hired a guy who they thought was a Michigan man, and it failed them. So I don't know what they do at this point or where they go or how they revive themselves at this point.
Yeah, it is going to be very interesting. And on the flip side of the coin, I love what you say about Miami, of my formative years and my childhood. Looking back on my teen years, I despised those teams at the time. I look back on them with such admiration because they made a mockery of a system that is a mockery. It's a great way you put it in the book. It's funny how we look at Miami now, and they seem almost soft and cuddly, don't they?
Yeah, they do, because we look at them, and you probably watched the ESPN documentary about them, sort of glorifying everything that they did. And I think when we do look back on those Miami teams, we see how they kind of broke the mold and how they did challenge a system that needed to be challenged and is still being challenged. And I don't think we would be as far along in those challenges to the system today if it wasn't for those Miami teams, if they hadn't kind of gummed up the works in the first place. Yeah, I hated them too. I think everybody hated them who wasn't rooting for them or wasn't going to school there, because they were the bad guys. But by playing the bad guys back then, they almost seem like the good guys today. In the bigger picture, you could see what they were trying to do and the way that they were trying to show that, like, okay, we're a bunch of kids, you know, who are coming from inner city Miami. We're poor kids, mostly black kids, who aren't getting opportunities and who are playing college football and are being exploited by this system. And I think there are a lot more people now who recognize that the system needs to change because of what Miami did back then.
You know what's funny? People hear you say that, and I say that daily on my show, things like that, just the exploitative nature of college football. It doesn't mean, though, and I'll speak for myself personally, and then I'm going to ask you, it doesn't mean that I dislike college football. In fact, it's the exact opposite. I think it's the greatest thing going, and it is because not only of the history, but as you talk about, it's so great because of its imperfections, because we're imperfect. We live in an imperfect world. And college football, as you point out in the book, mirrors that, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful mess, and that's the thing. I think if you get it, like you and I do, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do, being in Tennessee and being in Knoxville, you know, I think the people who get it understand that it's screwed up, and that there are things that are always going to need to be changed, and that there's a constant argument that we're going to be having, both about who should be number one and also about what the sport should be, whether it's exploiting the people at the center of it, whether it's good for the universities to be involved in this, how the money is affecting everything. We're going to be having those arguments constantly all the time. But then the games themselves are great because you have these kids who are not fully formed yet, and they screw things up and they miss field goals and they drop passes. And when you watch the NFL, it feels like guys who are at work and guys who are professionals and guys who are at this high level who don't make the same sorts of mistakes. And we just have this different level of expectations for what they are. And I love the NFL too, but I think college football for me is better because there is this baseline of guys who make mistakes. You can run different sorts of offenses because the guys on defense aren't quite as big or as fast. You can experiment more. Every kind of experimentation, especially on offense at this point, is happening in college football.
Absolutely.
The pros are taking the stuff from college football at this point. So that's where all the ideas are happening. That's where all the experimentation is happening. And those inherent imperfections in the sport are what elevate it above everything else, I think.
One other point about college football that I found to be true in my life, and I want your thoughts. I grew up in a pro town right outside of Philly, Eagles fan, the whole deal. The pain in college football when you lose a game, in NFL you get 16, and it's a playoff sport. In college football, Tennessee loses to Florida earlier this year, two teams that are going nowhere in a hurry. The pain from that game experienced by myself and this fan base here will never be forgotten. And every time you look at highlights from a game like that, you were mentioning the Sugar Bowl, January 1 of 79. I remember as a kid watching that in my grandmother's living room. I can still see the people's faces when Gooman got stopped on fourth down by, was it Barry Krause that went up and stopped him?
Yep.
And the pain involved in those losses in college football, there's just something about the sport. It brings you the highest of highs. But man, Michael, those lows, they're unlike anything you experience as a sports fan.
Oh, it's not even close. Think about the SEC, all the stadiums in the SEC and all the atmospheres in the SEC, including Knoxville, obviously. And if you ranked them and then you ranked the pro stadiums, let's say Seattle has the best home crowd, where would Seattle fit in the SEC in terms of best home crowds? What would it be, like 8th, 9th, 10th? I mean, it wouldn't even be close, you know? So I think the atmosphere that you get week to week at a college football game is completely unlike anything else, especially and unlike anything else in the NFL. I mean, people watch the NFL for the occupational expertise of it. And that's not to say there aren't rabid NFL fans and people, you know, who go to Eagles games or whatever else and are crazy about it. But it doesn't reach the same level as you'll see at LSU or at Tennessee or at Florida. I mean, it's not even close. And so I think that's part of it. And I think there's also just this idea that the college football season is so short. If you have a great quarterback or a great running back or a great receiver, he might only be there 2 years. You know, you got a really short window. The coaches are under constant pressure to win. Somebody like Butch Jones, I think he's improving that program, but let's say he doesn't improve it fast enough, he's gone. Same thing happened to Fulmer when he was there, where he just kind of plateaued. And it's like such a concentrated thing, and it goes so fast and it moves so quickly. The atmosphere is so intense that if you lose a game, it's very possible that you might be out. It all matters. And people say, well, the playoff is going to dilute the regular season. It doesn't really. I mean, you look at that Florida State-Notre Dame game. I know Notre Dame kind of fell down in those first playoff standings, but I still think they're in contention for the playoff. So both those teams are still in contention for the playoff. Did that diminish the atmosphere of that game or the ending of that game? Not at all. I mean, it was still a great game.
No, and you make the point, too, at the bottom part of the book, when you start wrestling, you say, hey, by the time you read this, the playoff starts at 4. It may end up at 8. It'll be 8 rather shortly, because as soon as we go through this first cycle, Michael, when those announcements are made and teams 5 and 6 are pretty indistinguishable from team 4, can you imagine how hot people are going to be that thought we were going to have some kind of rectification and justice? We're not going to have justice. We're going to have more questions and more finger pointing and more politics. And it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and it should be. I hope that they give this 14th playoff a little time to breathe and experiment with it. Give it a couple of years. Let's see what the issues are with it, and let's see how we should expand this thing. And I hope that the larger conferences don't take all the power away. I hope that there's still room for the smaller conferences to get in there. That, to me, is the biggest benefit of expanding the playoff. I want to see what a team like Marshall can do against Alabama or against Auburn. Maybe they'll get killed, but I'd like to see it. Why would you not want to see that? Especially when, you know, what happened with Boise State when they beat Oklahoma. It's one of the greatest games of college football history. Why would you not want to see that? You know, I don't understand that. I think there are people who just make these assumptions that, well, Marshall's going to get killed. Let's see it. Let's see what's going to happen.
Michael Weinrib, Seasons of Saturdays, A History of College Football in 14 Games. Hey, listen, it's about time for us to wrap this thing up. Give me a final word here, if you can. And I guess on the way out, share with me what maybe a couple of things from the book before you give me a final word that maybe were your favorite anecdotes that you were able to unearth in your research for this thing, because there's a lot in here.
Yeah, there is. I think it goes back to those games from the 1960s, because that was such a time of change, and it's just this moment of when the country was changing, and you could really see all those changes happening in college football at the same time. It was also fun to go back and read about how coaches have changed, too. Say this about Woody Hayes, just about Woody Hayes, that the idea of him equating football with military philosophy, and just how angry Woody Hayes was all the time, and how he's constantly on the edge of anger, and obviously got fired in a moment of anger. And I talk a little bit about how when I watch games, sometimes that anger flares up in me, and I think it flares up in a lot of us who are fans. But then you can see the evolution of the football coach, too, because one of the later essays I talk about Steve Spurrier and Mike Leach and coaches like that who are a bit more off the cuff and have helped evolve the game away from what Woody Hayes wanted it to be, which was, you know, this run-heavy, very conservative sport. it's now a very progressive sport, and now all these teams are running these crazy offenses and all these pass-heavy offenses. And so it's changed a lot, and I think the idea, the coaches have changed. The idea of what a football coach is has changed over the years, too. And so it was interesting to note that, too. And I think that's kind of what I wanted the book to be, was just a look at how this game has changed in so many ways, but yet the heart of it also remains the same all over all these years.
Michael, really appreciate your time today. Great talking with you, and best of luck to you on this book going forward with the holiday season. I hope a bunch of folks go out and pick this thing up, because I had a wonderful time reliving some moments of childhood and several things that I just didn't know about this great game of college football that I love so much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Tony.
All right, man. Michael Weinrib, one more time. Season of Saturdays. From Scribner, History of College Football in 14 Games. Check it out as this concludes another edition. And now back to you.